And welcome to Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Phil has a program Wednesdays at 6 called Classical Underground. I urge you to listen in. Today on the show, later, 5:30, you're going to be hearing from Charles Taku, an international lawyer. He has practiced at the International Criminal Court, representing Kenyan officials, and he, of course, represented accused at the former ad hoc tribunal for Sierra Leone. I don't see that word ad hoc used enough. They call it the International Tribunal. Ad hoc was the term that was used as these courts were established. He also represented accused at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He is also a professor, and he's the author of several books, I believe, on international law. And he is in the latest. There's a book from Baraka Books called Justice Belied, The Unbalanced Scales of International Criminal Justice. That's edited by Mr. Chartrand and John Philpott. And the first essay in the book is by Charles Taku. We'll be talking to him at 5:30. He's going to explain what he thinks has gone wrong with the international tribunals, particularly the ICC, which, as you know, there's been some turnover. Mr. Ocampo is now gone. He served for 9 years. He's Argentine. He became sort of the story, in a sense. Instead of talking about the tribunal, everybody talked about Mr. Ocampo, and not for good reasons. Now there is a new lead prosecutor, and the court has its problems. So we'll be talking about that. There's an announcement I think it's important everybody know that on Saturday, January the 10th, from 2 to 5 p.m. at 25 Cecil Street, the Steelworkers Hall, the Friends of the Cuban Five Committee are having an event at which the Cuban Council will be speaking, and there will be a film. The story of what occurred with the transfer of the Cuban Five this past now we're looking back, good old 2014, December 2014, was really the big story at the toward the end of the year. There couldn't have been a bigger one, actually. And it's got everybody speculating as to what will come next. Reading the Toronto Star, I'm not terribly happy with the – we have to be embarrassed, I think, the way the – Cuba matters discussed today. They have a piece by Oakland Ross. I don't know if you saw that, but Oakland Ross is sort of the regular man, features man, who he's writing about a terrorist, Mr. Posada Carriles. There's no question he was arrested. Let's move the subject from Cuba. He was arrested in Panama. And it was not disputed. He had dynamite. He had plans. He was going to murder the head of state of Cuba. That it was Fidel Castro at that time. And I forget the year, but he was prevented from doing so. The plan they had would have killed not only the target, but anybody in the room with him, which would have been several hundred people. And, of course, Posada Carriles, as has been discussed on this show at great length, was involved with the murder of 73 people in an airliner. So the writer for the Toronto Star today says, hero or villain? You know, you decide. And he starts by interviewing, he has a quote from former United States Ambassador Smith, Wayne Smith, quite well known to be an authority on this subject. And so he says he's a terrorist, unquestionably. So then he finds a bar in Miami where the guy says he's a hero. So there you got kind of a balance. You have your ambassador and authority, and then you have a guy in a bar in Miami, and Oakland Ross is satisfied to just say, there, you see, six of one, half dozen of the other. Listen, by the way, I do respect the opinions of people in bars in Miami, but credentials matter, you know. you could have found a professor in the bar in Miami, and then you would have had something. But Oakland Ross and the Toronto Star just, you know, run their mouths, as it were, and see if they can create more trouble. But anyway, we'll keep our eye on that. But again, Saturday, June the 10th, from 2 to 5 p.m., 25 Cecil Street, there will be a celebration of the release of the Cuban Five, which is, again, a remarkable story. Phil, we have a book here we want to talk about. You're reading it, and it has to do with Panama. What is this? And it's available at a different book list, but tell me what you know about it.
Well, first of all, I want to tell you the book has a local connection because its author, who is a I guess we used to talk about the Renaissance man. She's a Renaissance woman. Her name is Olive Senior. She lives here in Toronto. She's a Jamaican. She is a storyteller, a poet, and a historian. And as this book tells us, she's a very serious historian. It's called Dying to Better Themselves, West Indians and the Building of the Panama Canal. And for those people who don't know it, and I think that's most people, the Panama Canal, which, of course, today is at the center of world commerce, didn't get there by nature. God didn't put it there. It was built by human labor, and it was a tremendously difficult enterprise to build. And they needed lots and lots of labor. It was built in the closing years of the 19th and the beginning years of the 20th century. And the labor, by and large, came from the islands of the Caribbean. And the sickness rate, the death rate, it was high because the work was dangerous, and the climate was not conducive to that kind of hard industrial labor. And so she has written a history of it, and her history is centered actually on, of course, she talks about the financing and which businessman was behind it and stuff like that, but she centers the history on the people who built it. And she recalls in the early pages of the book growing up in Jamaica. And you'd see a picture in somebody's house that was a picture of an older person from an earlier era. Well, that's somebody who had gone to Panama or had somebody who had been in Panama, right? And so there was this connection, even as a child, that she recognized right away. There was a connection between Jamaica and Panama, which sometimes it wasn't even explained necessarily. It was just like part of the landscape of who Jamaicans were. And, you know, I got to say, you know, that I became aware of it, like so many other things in the world, as a baseball fan, because I used to notice how many baseball players came from Panama and would have English names, and yet they were Hispanic. They spoke Spanish. They didn't, you know, they spoke English with a Spanish accent. You said, isn't that odd? You know, like okay. I guess that was my first introduction, unconsciously, to the issue.
It was a heck of a story. There's a documentary film about it now. There's a second book. We're going to be talking about all of them. Last year was also, 2014, there was an anniversary, I forget which it is now, perhaps the 20th day of the U.S. invasion of Panama. Totally illegal operation, for which it is very proud. They said that the Noriega, the president of Panama, had been involved in the drug trade, and they asked Panama to surrender. I'm telling you, he's the president. And they decided to go and take him by force, and thousands of people died. Again, nobody here bats an eye. That's quite all right. You knock in the door of a sovereign state, you snatch the one you want, you put him on trial. By the way, I will grant 60 Minutes, the great Mike Wallace did an interview with him that was quite enlightening. Sitting in his prison cell, Wallace said, well, you used to be very close with the U.S. government, and they had no problem with you. They liked you. And he said, that's right. He said, you cooperated with the CIA, didn't you? He said, yes, I did. And he said, well, what happened? He said, well, they told me that I had to allow them to set up a Contra training base in Panama for attacks on Nicaragua. And I told them, we can't do that. And they said, there's going to be a price for that. And he said, now I'm sitting in a prison talking to you. That's the part I never see that cited. Why isn't that talked about? That is what you call basically in international parlance, crummy. That tells us something about this power, that Latin Americans are so suspicious of, because it regards itself as having the power to ignore international protocols, international law, and something that Dr. Charles Taku will be helping us with later in the show. But that was an outrage. As Roosevelt would have said, should live in infamy. But, of course, if victors write books or if those who run empires write them, then it's just a footnote. But it was a terrible moment. And of course, it all goes back to the building of the canal. By the way, this author is Olive Senior.
Yeah.
Olive Senior. Now, this book is available at a different book list on Bathurst, and I urge you to go there and obtain the book. And we will be talking to we are looking for you at the moment. But we know it's a great book and very important. Another thing I want to call attention to, a date, and we don't want to let it get slip past us by too many days, and that is that on December the 29th, 1890, the great leader, one of the great leaders of the Sioux Nation, a man named Spotted Elk, sometimes known as Bigfoot, was leading a band of his people away from what he thought was a dangerous situation. And he arrived at a weather just like this, by the way. Please check it out. Just if you want to get the feel for this story, go to look up Wounded Knee, Dakota, and South Dakota, I believe, and check the temperature. It's cold. And on the prairies, high prairies, it gets very cold. And he was known as a negotiator, as a politician, as a great leader, one with whom you could always talk. And he was one who was trying to cooperate with the great power in Washington. But because he was also the half-brother of Sitting Bull, and Sitting Bull had been the principal figure in leading the victory at the Little Big Horn, which humiliated the United States in June of 1876 when they were just getting ready to celebrate themselves and were setting up all the buildings, putting the bunting out, and the bands were all playing. Word came that they just lost their army to the Native Americans at the Little Big Horn. So then many years later, the 7th Cavalry, who has a long memory, were following Spotted Elk and his people. They had killed already Sitting Bull in December 10th or 15th. I don't know the precise date. They had killed Sitting Bull over the issue of the ghost dance. And the ghost dance was the native people of the region had been engaging in the ghost dance because they had been told that if they would do this, that the Messiah of the white people, Jesus, would return and bring justice. And they knew that if the Messiah would return and bring justice, then they would get their land back and the buffalo back, and they would go on with their lives, which had been destroyed. This idea was developed by a man named Vovoda, who is from Oregon, I believe, Oregon area today. At any rate, they engaged in the ghost dance. This made the white settlers unhappy and nervous. So the Indian Commission said, stop dancing. Which, you ever notice how this seems to be a white ruling class obsession? You're not to dance. Sit down. Do not, pull your pants up. There's a bunch of things you have to do. Don't wear that, and you can't dance. So in the case of the native people, they said, stop the ghost dance. Well, some did, some didn't. But this led to the confrontation where Sitting Bull, who was minding his own business, they approached him and wanted him to stop the dancing. And he said that was not within his powers to do. He wasn't against it. It was neither for nor against the people who wanted to stop it. No one was being harmed. It was a dance like a prayer to bring back the Messiah. So they had killed Sitting Bull. We won't go into his story today. But then they noticed that Spotted Elk was leading his people from the area. He was trying to get away from what he thought the danger was. And he was somewhere near the place called Wounded Knee. And the 7th Cavalry overtook his band. It was about, we estimate, I think, 300 people. And they surrounded them, and they said, now you're going to go where we tell you to go. And they took them to the place called Wounded Knee. And then they set up guns around them, and everybody went to bed, as it were. They made camp. But in the morning, a new white officer showed up for the Union Army, and he said, go and collect any guns in this camp. So somebody went out to do that, typical, I would think, U.S. Army detail, officious. And there were young men there who, not many, but some had weapons. Why not? You're living in an area with buffalo and hunting, and that's how you, you know. Anyhow, the expected happened. There was some altercation, and the American Army, the 7th Cavalry, opened fire. And at least 150 Native Americans were killed, including Spotted Elk himself. I urge you to go to your to the website and to see his picture, because when they came to bury all the, there were so many, they had to bring a special burial detail. December 29th, they were killed, and then there were several days they just lay frozen. There's a photograph of Spotted Elk, and he is covered with snow, but he's sitting up, or appears to be. He looks like he's trying to rise. And it is a terribly painful but compelling photograph, which everyone should have somewhere nearby, of Spotted Elk trying to get up. And probably, now today is the 5th of January, 2015, am I right? And they very likely that it's about this time that they were really completing the burial detail. It took them this long, because often killers never think about the next problem. You've done your deed. You've killed these people. Now what? So somebody had to come out. They had to bring in. They had to pay people to dig in the frozen ground, I suspect, which wouldn't have been easy work. At any rate, this is the other thing to know about this, so we want everybody to remember, is how easily medals are given out. 20 members of the 7th Cavalry were given medals for their heroic deed of killing women and children, Native Americans. And Dee Brown has written a great book titled Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which is really a line from a poem. American poet who said that he was fascinated by place names. Of course, by the way, place names will tell you history if you look at them closely. And he said he named this place and that place and that he thought was important. And then he said, bury my heart at Wounded Knee. Of course, Wounded Knee later in the 20th century became a great moment when Native Americans organized a resistance to the system the U.S. runs to manipulate and control Native population, and led to a confrontation in which Leonard Peltier eventually was charged. And so it gives me the opportunity not only to say, remember Wounded Knee, December 29, 1890, but remember Wounded Knee in the 20th century and the arrest of Leonard Peltier. And when you say, remember Leonard Peltier, remember that he was in Canada, the guest of Native people here, and he was forced out of the country. He was extradited on the testimony, I believe, of one individual who turned out not to be reliable. But he lost his freedom and remains in a United States federal penitentiary. Bill Clinton said, I'm going to free Leonard Peltier. He said, And particularly, I'm going to do this on behalf of Robert Redford, who has always asked me, please do something for Leonard Peltier. You have to, you know. And so Bill Clinton said, I promise. He served two terms, and he did not free Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier remains in custody. And so just to make everything nice and perfect, to show how 1890 is 1990 and et cetera, Sitting Bull came to Canada after the victory at the Little Bighorn. He led his people to safety in Canada. And for a period of time, he was permitted to stay because it was British North America. You've heard of that. And the British said, we have laws and whatnot. But the Americans said, we want him back. And the Canadian government actually didn't want his presence any longer. So they told him, you have to go. And they forced Sitting Bull to leave the country. It involved at one point, I noticed this little detail in history is now missing, but a RCMP official who actually boasted that he had kicked Sitting Bull. He said, he told me he didn't want to leave, and he was standing and by his horse, and he says, I kicked him. That was that was great. Sitting Bull returned to the United States, spent time with, of all people, Buffalo Bill Cody. He was met by presidents. Everybody found him very charming, very intelligent man. He went to Washington, and he said, I'm really sorry about the Americans. They have so many people don't have anything to eat, and they don't feed them. He said, I can't understand it. And he would take, always he had a little money in his pocket he would give to beggars because that's the kind of fellow he was. And so Cody made his tour around with Sitting Bull in the show. And his role, by the way, we'll have to examine that another time because there seems to be argument about was he a true friend of the Native Americans or was he, what was he? On the day that Sitting Bull was killed, the story was that he was trying to get there to see if he could save him. But at any rate, that all transpired. He lived peacefully. He wasn't heading up war parties or any such thing, but when the soldiers came to get him, as always, they became officious. Whatever, there was an exchange of some type, and he was murdered, in my opinion, murdered. Sitting Crazy Horse was also murdered. When you start looking that how come all these guys died, you know, each time they have a little explanation. Well, it was, you know, somebody said something, he argued, or we thought he was going for a gun, or we thought he had a relative who had a gun, so we shot him. And, it's like the Oakland Ross method. You know, he's six of one, half dozen the other. You're a guy in a bar in Miami or an authority. And in this case, they went on with that. So anyway, we're going to keep reminding people that this happened at Wounded Knee. December 29 was when he was killed, and they were killed. In 1890, which was pretty late. Some people call it the last great battle. If you can imagine, people freezing to death in a camp, shot up by an army that was already had put their guns in place to fire on them, and then you call that a battle, and then you bury the women and children. By the way, in a battle, how come you're killing women and children? I thought you said it was a battle. And how can 20 of you get medals? there's something to think about there. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to be talking to Dr. Charles Taku in a few minutes, not too long. And another matter that call your attention to, the Toronto Star, once again, my favorite people that I guess today, they have an editorial about what to do about John A. McDonald because his birthday is coming up. He's going to be 200. Congratulations, John. Their title is Judging a Hero and a Villain, and then they discuss him. But they, it seems to me they add to our problem, because part of this is understanding Canada, and they get off on the several problems with the way they approach this. They want to make him George Washington. Every country has to have a father, I guess. All right. Do some have mothers, but they always have to have a father. So they've decided it's John A. But, you know, John A. could not have done this well. There's a whole bunch of fathers, a bunch of mothers involved. Stress the mother part. But the crucial group were the people of Lower Canada who had made an agreement with the Crown. They were the French of North America. And the spokesperson, leader, the man in most involved, was George Etienne Cartier. And we shouldn't you know, we used to have a freeway. Phil, do you remember? It was called the McDonald-Cartier
Freeway.
It's not called that anymore.
No, the Highway 401.
They'd rather have a number.
Yeah.
If you say McDonald-Cartier, ooh, you're teaching history, aren't you?
Yeah.
See, you're driving along.
You're also making Cartier equal to McDonald. That's a problem, too.
Additionally a problem. You can't be the father. If they're fathers, there should be fathers. I'm tempted to do Tony Curtis's father, my father. His name is not mentioned in this discussion of our history. And then it talks about Canada, the nation. But, of course, the concept at the time was nations plural, because you had the English and French combining to form a confederation. Not that they used that word. Strangely, everybody's trying to figure out also who thought of the word dominion. Dominion is gone. We also had, hello, kids, we used to have a thing called Dominion Day.
And you know,
where did it go, Phil?
The Dominion Day disappeared under Trudeau. And, of course, a lot of—
Were you there when it disappeared?
I can tell you. I could tell you when it happened, but I wasn't watching. But, of course, the conservatives always thought this was a conspiracy by Trudeau. Conservatives are great at finding conspiracies against their British traditions.
Well, by conspiracy, they meant they didn't think of it.
They didn't think of it, and they didn't agree to it. But the Dominion, you know, has a biblical—
No, I know the origin of it.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, and it's very imperial. I mean, he gave them dominion over the land, and you know, so okay, so now John A. MacDonald has dominion over the land and the beasts and the birds and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
It's a little imperial.
So it did, but that's what should be. You know, there was the people who created Trivial Pursuit were asked once, are you going to develop a new game? And I said, yes, we're working on one now called Predict the Past. And you see, because there used to be Dominion Day, that's gone. So maybe Dominion has a future. We don't know. But definitely it doesn't help that the Star has got a McDonald obsession. And then they list his crimes. And I just was talking about Native Americans. Native Americans were really victims of a policy. You know, when you set a policy and you say, well, these people aren't going to have enough to eat if we do this, and the guy says, do it, that means you're going to kill them. They're going to suffer, and they're going to die. Now, so they rightly say that's one of the reasons they invoke the word villain. But hero wins out in the end, and like they do in all editorials. So the hero comes out. But they don't mention Louis Riel. And that was a major phenomenon in our history. And it has to do with, again, the French, because, as you know, Louis Riel was Métis. Louis Riel had the sympathy of the French people. And when they decided to hang him, the French said, don't do that. And all the most powerful people in the Quebec, what it is now called Quebec, new word, Quebec, they used to be Canada, by the way, but that's the way the ball bounces. So they said, do not hang him. But they hanged him anyway. And, well, you know, things have consequences. As a result of the hanging of Riel, according to many, many authors, none of them in bars in Miami, created, that was the beginning of what the sovereigntist movement, the drive towards sovereignty, was started with that decision, and that would be on John A.'s desk. So See, we got a lot to talk about with these people, and we will be doing that in the future. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back, and we will talk with Dr. Charles Taku.